Good evening, everyone.
Hello, this
Welcome to Pitch Portal. Go ahead, Larry. Welcome to the broadcast.
Oh, that's okay, Dorothy. I guess we can both bring it in. I waited for a pause there, and then I thought, well, you're waiting on me. Go ahead and tell the people what we're doing, and then introduce me, and I'll introduce Richard.
Okay. We have our favorite host, Larry Taylor, interviewing Richard Shaw, producer of the Watcher series videos that we all love. And Larry's going to take us down some rabbit holes with Richard, I think. So welcome to the broadcast, Larry.
Oh, thank you, Dorothy, and I appreciate it so much. And hang in there and buckle your seatbelt, because I don't really know where we're going, but I do want to introduce Richard Shaw. He's really a very unusual kind of individual. I can't even remember, actually. I can't even remember when I began to follow his work. I think even before Watchers 1 came out, I was seeing some data that he was working on. Maybe it was the Torah code or the Bible codes, but, you know, I picked up on Richard, especially when he was doing the Watcher series, and oh, my, I mean, that thing is incredible, the whole series. I just got my Watchers 8 the other day in the mail, and wow. I mean, that's all I can say is wow. It's incredible. You folks need to watch it. You need to watch all of them, 1 through 8, and then I think they're already working on 9, but Richard will let us know. But Richard, one thing that clicked my attention, I think first drew me to kind of researching a little bit of what work you did was when you began to work with, I guess, Glazerson and Harrelson, or Herrlich and Rips and some of those with the Torah codes, and you begin research on your own Torah code DVD. Now, that's been a couple of years ago it was supposed to have been out, but I know that things are working in that area. But I'll tell you what, you know, Richard, welcome to the show. And, I don't know where to go with this. Hardly. You've got your fingers in a number of pies, and I'm interested in every one of them, you know.
Well, Larry, it's great to be on. I always love being on your show. It's always a lot of fun, and thanks for inviting me. I really appreciate it. Yes, it's true. I've been working on the Torah codes for a long time. In them since I first learned about them from Michael Drosnin's book back in 1997. Just thought it was amazing and incredible. And through a really interesting experience, I was able to meet Professor Herrlich, who connected me to all of the world experts in the codes. And yesterday I got off the phone with Professor Rips in Jerusalem and told him I was looking forward to seeing him in a couple of weeks because we're headed to Israel.
Well, tell him I said hi. He may not remember me a lot, but a few years ago, I actually made contact with him, and he really piqued my interest when he sent me a very strange, it was just a bizarre email, and was talking like that the codes that they were running, that they're multidimensional. I thought, oh, my God, you know, more than just flat. I mean, they're more than just flat, like the planet, you know. I remembered so much back at the old movie Contact. I'm sure you remember that television
Sure.
show. You know, it was a movie, Contact, and within a code that was coming through that was an audio signal, they then found a video signal, and then they found like drawings to build things. And I mean, it was just so amazing. And I thought back on that when he sent me that email, and I know that Rips, who has an incredible history of even, I mean, it's historical that Rips is even in, or really even alive, and not only that, alive in Israel, and then alive in Israel doing the work he's doing in the codes and all of that data. I mean, it's incredible. I've studied a little bit of Rips. Man, I mean, you really got my interest today. Go ahead with what you had a conversation with him?
I did. Of course, I really love Professor Rips greatly and respect him. He's a brilliant and humble man. And once you meet a person like that, you're forever affected by them. And so whenever I have a chance to to meet or talk with him, it's always something very special. And he's a world-class mathematician. I mean, he could be teaching higher mathematics than any university in the world, and they'd all love to have him. On the codes, he's working on, he has some new discoveries he's going to show me that where basically he has full sentences he's found in the codes, and he's put a lot of time and effort into things to prove that the codes are real and not just by happenstance. So I'm looking forward to going to his house and seeing what he's got going. And then we've been talking with Dan Gordon, who is part of the IDF. He has dual citizenship here in America and also in Israel, and he's a really great writer. Been writing stories about what's really going on with Hamas and the tunnels and the whole deal. And Dan is going to also be part of this film. This film is something I've wanted to do literally for years, Larry. And we didn't have the money to do it until just a few months ago. And we started planning the trip, and then war broke out in Israel. And then we all looked at each other and said, this is why God was stalling the process, because he wanted us to be there now. I really believe, and all of us working on it believe that's the case.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've been watching. I knew you were going, and a little bit of the time frame you were going in, and I really had prayed about that, because right now it's terrifically dangerous over there. But if the Lord sends you, he also protects you and prepares the way for you, especially if there's a work for you to do. And I'm
sure,
hoping now that possibly this is a time that Israel will be able to relax and have a time of peace. I hope for a little while. And maybe you guys, I'm hoping that, you guys get over there in a time of somewhat tranquility, that y'all can work, and because I'm really, really interested in what information and data you guys will put together. When I begin to think about all of the heads coming together, so to speak, and I know what you're talking about with Dan Gordon. I've been following some of his postings, and I think you sent me a couple,
right,
too. And he's a super guy. I mean, he's a super guy, and so this has got to be good, whatever you're going to do.
Dan has a brilliant mind. He's written a lot of really great movies. I mean, he wrote The Hurricane with Denzel Washington. He did Murder in the First, and he wrote Passenger 57 with
Snipes.
Yeah, and he also,
mm-hmm,
before all of that, how I got acquainted with him, I had seen a movie that got pulled from theaters early because the distributor went out of business right after the film was released. It was a really cool movie called The Assignment. The Assignment had Ben Kingsley and Donald Sutherland in it, and Aidan Quinn starred in it, and Dan Gordon wrote it.
Mm.
And it was all about a terrorist that they were looking for, and another guy had to pretend he was the terrorist because he looked just like him, the Aidan Quinn character became the terrorist. But what was so intriguing about the film, it was that whoever wrote the film had to have a lot of inside knowledge on how Israeli defense forces. And I mentioned that to my wife, Mary. I said, after watching the film, whoever wrote this film had to know the inner machinations of what goes on in Israel, because it was just too intelligent of a movie. And then I find,
mm-hmm,
out Dan wrote it. So, a couple years ago, I spent 3 days at his house, and we talked for hours. And I can't even begin to tell you all the things we talked about, but Dan is one of the smartest guys I know. And he's also in the reserves for the IDF, the Israel Defense Force, and acts as almost like a PR voice for what they're doing over there. He's very aware of it. So what we're trying to get now through his commanding officer is permission to use him in the Torah Code piece in uniform. And I want to go into some of those tunnels, and I want to see what's going on with the whole Hamas thing. well, you know, if it's safe enough to go in those areas, because Hamas just broke the truce again. The ceasefire has been broken. They were going to have a 72-hour ceasefire, and Hamas will not extend it.
Huh.
So what's fascinating is they've spent and it seems like the majority of the people that aren't keeping up with this are all on the side of the Palestinians because they don't understand anything about Hamas or Hezbollah or any of that or what's going on with Iran and how Iran is funding some of this stuff that's going on. But Hamas spent $2 billion on that tunnel system. $2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
They asked for concrete and steel and all this stuff to rebuild their houses after the 2012 war. Instead, they built tunnels to kill Jews in Israel. That's really what their whole thing is. And they're very vocal about saying why what their intent is. And I truly, as much as it pains me, I don't believe there will ever be peace in Gaza until all those people are gone. It just doesn't seem like they will ever come to any sort of peaceful it will just, you know, fire back up in a couple of years after they've restocked their weapons. That's what I think the situation will be.
Well, I know that, or I believe, if I remember right, I think Professor Rabbi Gleiberson was working on some codes, wasn't he, involving some of that? Or it might have been Herrlich.
When I see him in Jerusalem, the two of us are going to have to spend most of the day together working on deciding which are the best tables to use in the program. But he has this table with codes in it that talk about, remember the three boys that were kidnapped at the beginning of the whole war? And
yes,
the table came up with the names of the three boys, keywords, and then it says where they were found in Hebron. All that's in one table. The odds of that are just astronomical.
Absolutely.
So then recently they found another table that talks about Golden. Remember the officer, the IDF officer that was killed during the ceasefire with Hamas? And that all came up in the table. So I want to talk with Reps and Glazerson about those tables. And then we just had Art Levitt and also Dr. Rotenberg agree to be interviewed. So we're going to have a real power-packed show here with the Torah codes and also what's going on in Israel with the military and all of those things. It'll be a pretty exciting show when we get done.
Wow. Boy, you talk about timing, too. This is the time to glean all that information, too, because it's all kind of coming together, it seems.
Well, it is, and you know, there was a man that wanted to see this film get made and just funded it for us, and, which I don't know if he wants his name repeated or not, but I'm very grateful.
Maybe not, unless you...
if he's listening in, he knows who he is, and I just want to say thank you and show my appreciation but then again, his donation to get this film going, propitious moment, because now we have much more to talk about than we would have if we were just doing the codes. Plus, I plan on doing updates for LA's blog line there that LA will put up. I'll give you guys updates on Israel, video updates, and then also we'll put some information that we discover while we're there into Watchers 9.
Oh, man. Mm. Well, I'll tell you
what. That's kind of the plan.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing. You know, I watched Watchers 10 really close, and I saw that just absolute excellent work that Dr. Roger Lear did. And that, eight. Uh-huh.
The last one that we just released was Watchers 8 just a couple weeks ago.
Right. Yeah, I've seen that, and he was on that with an incredible work, you know, that he has done, and I'll sure miss him. I mean, I know most people already know he passed away, I guess, during the putting together this last DVD, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was getting the last few things shot and starting on the edit for the film, and he called me and said he was going into the doctor because his foot was hurting really badly, and I wished him well, and 2 days later, he was dead. And he's had this illness since, well, if you remember back to Watchers 4, where we had this interview with Roger in the parking lot, he had a cane, and he looked a little gaunt, and that was the first of this illness that he had, and I thought he was getting better, but he came over to see me a week before he passed away, and I gave him a big hug, and he was so frail and light that, I mean, it was just like, it was unbelievable. But, I don't know, Roger was an incredibly lovable, brilliant, witty, funny, interesting, great encourager. I can't say enough good things about Roger Lyric. He's a close friend, and I miss him a lot.
Well, I'll tell you what, I enjoyed all of his work. I followed it very closely, and I was going to mention something to you. I think you told me, I may be wrong, but didn't you say that the last, I don't know what you call it, chip or object that he removed was his 17th one?
Yeah, the last implant surgery that we all did together, and I was honored to be there shooting it and experiencing it, was number 17. How many implants removed?
Just dealing with mathematics, I looked up the number 17 in The Keys to Scripture Numerics by Ed Lowe, because I'm intrigued by numbers. And guess what? Guess what 17 represents, the 17th. It represents victory and completion.
Oh, wow. Very interesting.
Yeah, and it says, Ed Velo wrote a note, said, it's a deeper significant number of the testimony of the completeness or victory that is found in the Lord. So I thought, wow. When you told me 17,
wow.
I had to look it up, and I hadn't talked to you about that, but I wanted to bring that up because it seems significant that the last one, the 17th one he removed, it seems like he had done his work. I mean, you know?
Huh. Oh, that's pretty cool. I didn't know that about the number 17.
It was so amazing.
Yeah, and before he died, we had a really great discussion. He'd call me late at night, we'd talk for an hour. But I said, you know, Roger, I said, you've taught me so much about this that I feel like I actually know what you're talking about now. I had to laugh because he uses a lot of big scientific terms to describe stuff. And, you know, when we first started, I was, you know, I'm not a dummy, but I mean, this is like another field. This is part medical, part scientific, part physics, and part supernatural. I mean, it's all the stuff I like anyway. I'm a weird person.
Exactly. Exactly. My.
But, you know, by the time he passed away, I told him, I said, you know, you've given me an education on this whole process and how it works, and I think I could actually carry on if I knew someone that thought they had an implant, if we had a doctor that was, you know, willing to perform surgery to pull them out. And I would think, I haven't talked to Dr. Matriciano about that, but he would probably still, you know, act as a surgeon to remove these things. He's done so many of them too in working with Roger. And he's a really nice guy.
Well, you know, the interesting thing that I found in Watchers 8, when he did actually his last one, and it was so it was almost invisible, but then visible. It was like it was elusive, you know? And
right.
Tell us about that, how that really happened, because that's really strange how that you knew it was there and then you couldn't find it when he actually was going to remove it. And you guys got all this on video.
Yeah, it was Larry, it was very, very strange. I mean, we know we're already working in an area that's pretty weird to begin with, and we're aware of that. But we go into this in a very lighthearted nature. In fact, Rogers used to be cracking jokes through the process like he is in the film. You know, it's like, you know, he bent over, and I'm holding my camera shooting the surgery, and he goes, "Rick, Rick." And I go, "What?" He's like, he's bugging me because I'm trying to take pictures, you know. And he's going, "Can you get my glasses?" And his glasses were on top of his head. And I said, what do you do with them, Roger? And he goes, "I need you to take them off for me." I said, "Okay." So I lay them on the counter, and he said, "I can't stand the sight of blood."
Oh, my.
And then that's so typical of Roger to make a joke right in the middle of when they're cutting the guy's leg open, you know. It was just dark humor. It was just so funny. You know, and then later on, Dr. Matriciano is making the first incision, and he's asking Bill, our implantee victim, "How's that? Do you feel anything?" And Roger goes, "No, I feel just fine, thank you." So Roger kept the whole thing really lighthearted through the whole time. But before that, 2 weeks earlier, we had, because anytime you do a surgery, you have to do something by law called a pre-op test. It means that you go in, you determine where the exact spot is, and you see if you can find this object using another device than what you've already done. So before all that, our research had shown that there was an object in Bill's leg, and we used a simple Home Depot stud finder, because those stud finders are for finding a metallic object behind something, right, in a wall or even in your leg.
There you go.
Inexpensive but effective, okay? And the stud finder went off at the exact place where the object was. We had taken 4 x-rays, and Bill had taken one himself and sent it to me, so that's 5 x-rays. And then we paid to have a CAT scan done of Bill's leg. CAT scan shows the three-dimensional slices of the body. So it also showed the implant clearly. We knew exactly how big it was. We knew how deep in the skin it was. We knew how far away from the bone it was sitting. We knew everything about it. A detailed report was written out and given to Dr. Lear that he read during the surgical procedure, and I left it in the film because I wanted people to know that this isn't baloney. There was no science behind this. So in the pre-op test, we used an ultrasound device, and Dr. Matriciano put the probe on Bill's leg, and about a minute later, there was the implant. It just appeared really quickly. He said, "Oh, well, this isn't going to be so tough. There it is." I said, "Okay, when do you want to schedule this, Roger?" I said, "Can we do it this weekend?" He goes, "Oh, no, I have to get people to verify this as witnesses." He wanted 3 cameras. He wanted like a monitor in the lobby so that everybody could watch. So I had to get ready for all of it. And I put everything together like he wanted. We had an HD monitor in the surgical room that we could all look at. We had 2 other cameramen, Ruben and Jeremy, brought their Canon 5Ds. And I was shooting. I was shooting the surgery and Roger and the monitors and all of that stuff. And we ran it through an HDMI splitter so that people in the other room could see through a big HD monitor what the surgical procedure actually looked like, so they didn't have to be in the room with us. And so we were set. So the first thing was Dr. Matriciano switches on the same ultrasound machine we used the other day, puts some lubricant on Bill's leg, puts the probe down, and can't find it.
Huh.
And he moves it a little further, and he can't find it. And
Uh-oh.
He moves it to the side, and it doesn't show up. Well, he went back and forth over that little area on Bill's leg for more than an hour.
Oh,
my. At this point, Jeremy and I are filming all of this. And didn't expect it to be taking so long, and we're hand-holding our cameras because there really wasn't room to put big tripods up in the surgical room. We were just holding the cameras and trying to get up close and get interesting shots of it for posterity. Mm-hmm. And so what ended up happening was that we couldn't find it. So I began thinking, you know, I was kind of just praying internally that, you know, Father, you know, we've put out a lot of effort here, and also
we sure could use some help
out of his body, you know, and we need to show that this is real, that we're not making this up, that this is a real physical object.
Exactly.
And I'm doing that quietly, and then L.A. just kind of comes out and goes, this may seem a little weird, but I'm going to say a prayer. And out loud he just says, you know, Father, we just pray that whatever's cloaking this device would that you would break that and do it soon. And as soon as he prays that, wasn't 2 minutes after that, the implant suddenly appears on the ultrasound machine.
Wow.
Now, this is after going over that same spot on Bill's leg for an hour and not seeing anything.
My.
It was weird.
You know.
It was very weird.
I'm sure you did. You saw Steven Spielberg's film, that series Taken. Remember that?
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a long time. I don't think I've ever seen the series all the way through, and I should probably find it on Netflix or something and see if I can see it.
Yeah, they've got.
And there was also
they've got some. Matter of fact, I've got a DVD of the whole series, and they've got in part of that series they do the very same thing. They try to get an implant out of some victims, and the implants are elusive. Not only do they move, they cloak and hide in that movie. I mean, and you know, one of the reasons I know that Spielberg worked so hard on that was when he got a hold of Tom Horn, who I'm sure you've heard of. You know, you're familiar with Tom.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, but anyway, Tom Horn, I think, had an aunt or a sister. It might have been a sister. That was because I talked to Tom one time, and I think his sister had been abducted, was a victim, and Spielberg brought her, I'm not sure where, Hollywood, L.A., somewhere, and actually interviewed her for that movie, and so he could get accurate to what, an abduction experience was like. And so that reminds me a lot of what you guys just went through, you know?
Well, I know, like, you know who Whitley Strieber is?
He was
the first really abductee that they made a movie out of called Communion, starring Christopher Walken.
I saw that.
And it was, in fact, I even know the director, Philippe Mora, who I met a few years ago, and we talked. But I've heard Whitley talk at various events that I've been to, even filmed him talking at times. He had an implant in the outer portion of his ear, you know, call that, where you're the outside of your ear.
The cartilage, it's kind of a cartilage area.
Yeah, and so they were using, I don't know if it was a C-arm or some way they could x-ray it in real time and see this device, and it was crawling around in there.
Oh,
and
my.
It was metallic. And it hurt like the dickens when it would do that, so they stopped, and he part of his ear removed to get rid of it. But he decided just to leave it in because it was too problematic to go after it. And, of course, Roger has told me that sometimes these things move. In the case of Bill's leg, it didn't move. It just didn't show up.
It was like
very
it was cloak,
weird.
Wasn't it?
It was, well, there's this high strangeness because it's a metallic object. I saw it after it was taken out. It looked, you know, about the thickness of a pencil lead. It was slightly bent. Under the electron microscope, it looked very crystallized on the outside. Didn't look like just a piece of metal. It was encrusted with some kind of crystalline substance, and then all of that was inside of a this typical coating that we see on all of these implants. It's usually kind of a gray little sack that covers them almost like an insulation type of thing.
Mm.
And so when Steve Colburn got out a scalpel and cut the end of it off and squeezed this thing out, then he peeled it off, and there's a close-up of that I took at the time. I thought this was really intriguing to actually watch one of these come out of their little protective membrane.
Yeah.
That thing, it's what keeps the body from rejecting it. And yes,
oh, okay. That
even though
perfect
it's covered
sense.
With
yeah.
that, yeah, mm. even though it's covered in that material, it there's this, there was evidence of carbon fibers attached to it. Now, this isn't carbon nanotubes. This is like mm-hmm. nerve endings
mm.
that were growing out of it, is all I can say. I mean, I could see that clearly
wow.
in the electron microscope view that we have of it. And when we did EDX analysis, they proved to be 95% carbon, which means it is a piece of flesh from inside the leg. So after this all happened, and after prayer foiled the cloaking process,
uh-huh.
I talked to Roger, and so did LA. We both talked to him. I talked to Roger for an hour the next day. It was like Saturday. I'll never forget this. And I said, Roger, I now believe that these devices are externally controlled. And he said, I agree with you 100%.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, then if they are, maybe they're injecting signals into the nervous system instead of us sending signals out. And I'm beginning to think that
yeah.
my theory is that these things are in there to modify the human nervous system. LA goes as far as wondering if they're actually changing the DNA. I'm not sure. I can't say that for certain because we would have to have had Bill's DNA sample from before he was implanted and then one after we took it out and then compare, and we don't have that kind of those resources to do that with. But I think that they're in there for a reason that only they know. And it's definitely alien. It's definitely a supernatural thing. And, the other thing I didn't mention, Larry, was in Watcher 7 is where we show our initial testing of this implant in Bill's leg. And we go through mm-hmm. all the scientific test procedures with it. We show the x-rays, the CAT scan, and then we show the three little boxes that we use as test equipment. One was a Gauss meter that registers magnetic flux density. Another one was the simple Home Depot stud finder just to prove there was a metallic object in Bill's leg. And the third thing was a frequency counter. And that also registered a very high frequency signal when the antenna was placed over the area.
It's kind of like a sender. It has a sender signal, a frequency that goes out from it.
It does, and I don't know if it's, I mean, the signal is so high, I'm torn to know whether it's 330 gigahertz, because the device had a clamp-off frequency of 3.3 gigahertz, and yet it was reading 333. I don't know what it was reading. I've talked with Dr. Brooks Agnew about it. I've talked with Professor Herlick about it. They said, well, if it was the latter, then it really is beyond an FM frequency band. It's more in like a microwave signal, super high frequency.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And unfortunately,
let me ask you something. If I remember right, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in one of the Watcher series, it seems like Dr. Lear began to notice that I think I'm right, that some of these implants even changed or seemed to do something different even after they were removed. I mean, there was still activity with the implants. Was that true?
I've asked him about that, and I said, you know, what happens after they're removed? And they'll go off, that kind of thing. And apparently, sometimes it does for a few hours, but then it becomes inert and doesn't do anything. And also he said that the, you know, the coating that is rather pliable when you remove it. He said later, if it's not kept within some of the body's own blood serum, it becomes hard. Like he said, he always used the phrase, you could crack it like a nut after a couple days.
Wow.
It's the, oh, I do have a, the pathology lab that looked at the coating came back. Roger told me that they said that there was no sign of inflammation or infection.
Wow.
And if there had have been, it would have been, it would have showed up in that little piece of tissue that was sent to the pathology lab.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me
and
ask
this
you
thing
this,
was in Bill's leg for since he was 5 years old, and he's 45 now.
Oh, wow. Let me ask you, this is just an opinion, okay? I'm just asking your
sure.
opinion. Throughout a number of the individuals that had implants, what was it that clued them into the fact that they might have one, that they would even go check and see or have Dr. Lear x-ray or scan or search for that in their bodies?
In other words, kind of on a case-by-case basis. There's different, they each have different experiences. In my experience of learning about these people that have been implanted, they're not all, it doesn't all happen the same way to them. Well, I mean, it does, but it doesn't.
Okay.
There was a guy named Tim Collins that had an implant. I wrote about his experience because Roger told me about it in our book, Further Evidence, that L.A. and I co-wrote.
Sure.
And in that, what happened to Tim was he was driving his car home through a very desolate area. I think it was in Colorado. I have to go back and reread it to make sure what state it was. But it was late at night. He was with his wife. He saw a light coming from behind. They thought it was a truck or something. And then this thing went right over their car and landed in a field off to the left side. And that's the last thing he remembers until he was driving home again. And gets home and he's like, it took him 7 hours to get home when it should have only taken two. So he had missing time.
Missing time.
He did not
Absolutely.
Remember what happened to him. He just remembered seeing this craft flying over his car and landing in a field in a bright light. That's all he remembers. So later, he's a construction guy, kind of a big, burly individual. He was pounding on something and accidentally hit his thumb with a hammer and really hurt his thumb real bad. So he went into the doctor, and the doctor does an x-ray, and just to be safe, the doctor x-rayed his whole arm. So, well, you know you got a piece of metal in your wrist. And he said, no, I don't. He said, look, there's no scar. There's nothing to prove that anything's ever been in my wrist. So, well, here it is right here on the x-ray, and showed it to him. So when that happened, Tim put two and two together. Now, Tim is like from a small town. He's not like thinking about aliens. That's not part of his mantra, okay?
Right.
But he realized that he had had this weird experience because he saw this thing fly over his truck. And now he's got something metallic in his wrist with no entry wound or scar or anything, and it's in his body. And so he contacted Dr. Lear a long time ago, and that's how he ended up getting it surgically removed. And when he talks about it, he often tears up. It was like an emotional experience for him.
Wow.
And then,
hey, listen,
then
let me I didn't want to interrupt what where you're going, but we're headed up towards the top of the hour, and I
okay.
wanted you know, you mentioned that missing time. There's an image on the top of the banner area there of the website with a image you sent me. Could you explain some of the photography work or some of the work you've done into not only looking into who these are or where they come from, but their craft, also the missing time? Just explain, you know.
Well, I'd be happy to. I'm going to that page here so I can see it. The picture in the website is really small. You have to look at it kind of big. I don't know how large you can get it, but the image was, after we did Watcher 7, I was able to beg and plead with Roger to let me use his original video of the Kambirgash UFO from Turkey. And mm-hmm. Roger had, like, a super high, a digitized version of the original tape, but it was high quality. It's not like YouTube video.
Wow.
It was real high quality.
Right.
So he gave me that, and I promised him, I said, look, if you give me that, I'll up-res it to high def for you, color correct it, and give it back to you on a thumb drive so you have a really good copy for yourself. He goes, oh, okay, great. So we did that. Well, after I up-res it, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And so I remembered Roger had told me that there was this guy in Chile that had done an analysis of the actual tape that this thing was shot on. Now, this was shot in 2009 on something, if I remember right, it was something like a Canon GL2 camera for all the camera buffs out there. I don't know what I'm talking about. The NTSC camera uses mini DV tape, and then he had a 200-millimeter screw-on Sony teleconverter on the lens. So, I mean, it's not like, this isn't like super high-end equipment, but it's not bad equipment. It's kind of like
mm-hmm.
better than, it's like prosumer level, I guess you'd call it. So Yeltsin, the guy who actually shot it, had zoomed all the way in, and you get quite a bit of vignetting around the image because of this screw-on telephoto filter. Fortunately, he had that. And Mario Santiago in Chile had somehow ended up with the original tape that sent to him, and he stripped the fields out of it and started zooming in on it with his computer and could see a third alien in the shot. Now, you remember, like, Roger always talked about this, that you could see two large alien heads in the window, and you actually can with no trouble at all. You can see them clearly, like gray,
right.
with the big eyes and all of that. But
mm-hmm.
when I started really zooming in on it, I could see something moving to the right, so that's why I went to Mario's website, and he had seen a third alien creature that looked like some sort of insectoid with the big eyes and all of that, moving incredibly fast. So after we finished Watcher 7, and by the way, we won two awards on that. It was really humbling, and I felt really honored to be getting those awards from the International UFO Congress just a few months ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, was startling to us that they would give us an award, and we were very grateful. But after I finished Watcher 8, I began to get curious about that third alien that I'd read about and seen sketches of. But I wonder if even on this digitized version I could see it. So I decided to not do this in Final Cut Pro or anything like that, but actually take the video into After Effects, which is a professional effects program that has subpixel
mm-hmm.
positioning and also has like a curved effect where you can do curves just means that you can adjust black and white levels until you can really see what's in a dark area of a shot, where just normal brightness and contrast isn't enough. And
right.
so I used the curves filter on it, and all of a sudden I could start seeing something moving to the right of the two aliens. So then I zoomed way in on it, and it was just a blur. It was just like moving back and forth. I knew something was there, but it was jittery, hard to see, so I thought, well, perhaps there's time dilation going on here, as I had kind of suspected that there might be. So I slowed the video way down to 25% its actual speed, and when I did that and used the curves a little more and zoomed in slightly more, I could see the third alien turning its head. I could see it had two very large black eyes. It had slightly darker complexion than the two aliens next to it. It's definitely there. It's not. I'm not making this up. I didn't draw it in. I just increased the contrast and could actually see it. And you and I have
That's
talked
incredible.
About this insectoid-type creature, you know, and other people have said that they've seen these, and now we have video proof that they exist.
That's incredible. Absolutely. And you know, like, you know, you and I have chatted a little bit, and, you know, I've met one of those. You know, I told you about that. I shared that with you.
Oh, I do.
And
that's the first thing I thought
of. It's pretty
of.
Rare. Yeah, it's pretty rare. Not, you know, you hear a lot of people talking about grays. I mean, that's pretty common. And or I guess you could say that's pretty common. But you don't hear people talk much about those others. And for you, man, oh, man, you know, what I'm looking at here is just really incredible. I mean, it's amazing. Now
well,
explain to me, if you can, Richard, about, you talked about time. What did you say, dilation or?
Right. I looked it up, and basically, and I mentioned this months ago to Roger, that of what I thought was really going on with the Cumberbatch UFO, and we were on our way to get something to eat together late at night, and we were walking through the parking lot, and as I explained my theory to Roger, he yells out really loudly, "That's brilliant!" I miss his enthusiasm. I really do. Gosh, I love that guy. But anyway, I said, I think, you know, we've got basically where Yeltsin's camera was and the position of the ship hanging over the body of water. The ship is in its own time domain, and the cameraman was in his own time domain. So it's an illusion that these creatures are moving faster than they actually appear to be. And I think it's the same deal when you see a ship that looks like it's going 5,000 miles per hour. It's actually not. It's probably going 1/10.
Yeah.
It's all an illusion because they're generating a gravitational field. And when they do that, they're warping time. And this is why people have missing time experiences when they get too close to a ship and all of that.
Yeah.
And maybe some of these beings can generate that field on their own without technology, but what we're seeing now, and what also there's a guy named Paul McGuire who's starting to get to know a little better, and Paul told us on Watchers 8 that it was very disturbing to him to have to embrace the fact that the spiritual and the technology aspects sometimes are intertwined, and I really
there
believe
you go.
That's what's
going
on here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had talked to Stan Deo one time years ago about, he shared with me about time experimentation that he had seen that was, I believe, probably a black project with the U.S. government or associated with it. And then I had talked to him on a radio show probably a year ago or so about, I mentioned time, and he began to talk about time inside the craft of these individuals and the time of the person, like outside the craft looking at it or taking pictures of it, was different.
Right.
It was parallel, but it was different. And, you know, I always wondered, too, you know, I've taken some pretty bizarre photographs up here in the gateway, so to speak, and, you know, I sent you some copies and shared with you, and some of it looks rather bizarre, and a lot of it looks like maybe it's not completely formed yet or it's not quite, it's fuzzy. And that might account for some of that, you know?
Well, I think so. And I don't know if you know this, but remember Bob Lazar, who went on...
Oh, yeah.
Years ago, he was interviewed by George Knapp on...
Art Bell interviewed him, I think, on Coast to Coast a couple of times.
Well, no doubt. But I think the first interview was George Knapp for Channel 13 TV in Las Vegas, Nevada. And Bob Lazar said he had worked for at near Area 51 in Groom Lake, and that he did all these things, and that they hired him to back engineer UFO craft and all of that. And at first it sounds very fanciful and you know, oh, yeah, right, you know, what kind of tale is this? When you really listen to what he's saying, in my early days in television, television was a lot different in the late 70s than it is today. Back then, there were huge tape machines. I mean, they were like 2-inch quads. They were incredibly complicated. They had air guides and vacuum assist for sucking tape through the machine, and they had a head wheel that spun, you know, like at 10,000 RPM or something. And it was like very complicated servo motors and control of the tape and then all of that stuff. So in those days, just to record broadcast quality images, the engineering team had to be really smart. It wasn't just like a TV repairman kind of guy. These were people who were really smart. And all of my friends in those days that I knew talked just like Bob Lazar talked. So I've hung out with brilliant engineers that I really respect, and I know that I love talking with people who are who have quick minds and who delve into this stuff. Some of my best friends are brilliant friends because it's just more fun hanging out with geniuses than it is with guys that just want to watch football on Sunday afternoon.
There you,
you
go.
Know what I'm saying? And
yeah, I agree. 100%.
Bob Lazar, when I hear Bob talk, I know he's telling the truth. I'm totally convinced. It's like everything he says makes total sense. And in 1991, he came out with an instructional video explaining how these ships levitate, how they warp gravity, what their power source is, and everything.
Mm.
And when you understand that, when you watch that film, and you can still order it today, it's on UFOTV.com. If you haven't seen it, it's on YouTube, but I would rather people buy it from UFOTV just so that Bob Lazar would get the benefit of, the, of that purchase, because I think he deserves it. Because he was hassled like crazy for years after divulging this information. And most of the time, the government doesn't care because they think no one's going to believe it anyway. They just think, well, this is all, you know, people are just going to just think this guy's crazy and we don't have anything to worry about. Let him talk about it all he wants. But it's really, I think he's telling the truth. And here's why I say that. I won't go on too long on this if you don't want me to.
That's okay.
He explains how the ships are powered, which I thought was really interesting. They have a reactor on board, and they use element 115. Now, in UFO circles, it's kind of referred to for years as unobtainium, the element that they use to make their power. Well, it's actually element 115, and he says if you bombard it with protons, and in the video, he actually shows a little model of how this thing works. It's amazing.
Mm.
This little tube comes up to the side and bombards this proton particles into this, and for a split second, it becomes element 116, and when it does that, it emits a small amount of antimatter. I mean, it sounds like Star Trek, I know, but that's how they're getting warping space and time, is because they have so much power to work with, and they have these gravity generators on the ship that does it. Well, just recently, a physics magazine, as well as National Geographic, put out a notice that now on the periodic table of the elements, it's been discovered in a Russian lab. They've actually created it using a particle accelerator.
That's probably tied in somehow to these super colliders.
Yes, exactly. That's what a particle accelerator is. What they did was they took one, I forget which heavy metal they used as the basis of it, they bombarded it with a calcium atom, which had 20 floating electrons, and that brought them up to the 115 figure that they needed. And I guess it existed for a millisecond or something, but they were able to prove that element 115 was real.
Mm.
Now, it's not something that we have in abundance, and it has to be made, you know, in a lab.
Uh-huh.
But this isn't science fiction. This is fact.
There you go.
It's really
there you
happening.
Go. That's the truth.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's what I, you know, and I have friends of mine who are Christian friends that think
mm-hmm.
I'm nuts. And I said, look, we're not making this stuff up. I've held these implants in my hand. We've tested them in the lab. We're not just
right.
saying there's something without putting them through tests. And they disappear under ultrasound and then reappear after prayer. I mean, I know
mm-hmm.
this is weird, but I think we're about to see some really amazing things happen in this world that most people are just totally unprepared for.
I think you're right. And you know, Richard, I don't know how to get, you know, a lot of the shows that I do, you know, I do dip into some of the what they call the bizarre, I guess, but yet what I know and have experienced, I know is real, but how do you get to the point where you can really explain to them to where they believe it? It's a gap I've never been able to bridge, you know. They either believe you or they don't. But, you know, just like you're talking about this new element, there it is in the periodic tables. It's real. It's not made up. It's not really Star Trek at all. It's real, you know.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, there's going to be some people who stubbornly will refuse to believe anything that doesn't make sense to them, and that's fine. And, you know, as much as I'd like to help all those people, you can't. There's going to be, there's going to be people that believe it and people that don't. And the only thing I know to do, I don't think that being like a Bible thumper, as people sometimes call them, is the answer here. I think what we have to do is present all of this material as factually and scientifically as possible, and then we show prophetic scriptures and ancient texts that not just the Bible, but also the Book of Enoch and these other texts
sure.
that are appearing here that we have access to today. And
uh-huh.
try to understand what it is that we're seeing. But I'm telling you, once you start looking at this stuff, and I almost hate using the word supernatural, because to me it's like it's explainable now. It's no longer this foggy, you know, anamorphic, dreamy thing. This is reality. It's just don't have the vision to see beyond certain frequencies of light. Our bodies are not ready yet for that. And I think that's why the scriptures say we will all be changed. Because
mm-hmm.
if we're going to survive this, something has to happen to us, Larry. I really believe that. We're just
yeah.
not equipped to deal with this yet. But I don't believe that a loving God would leave us in this condition forever without, you know, giving us the tools we need to know what's going on. I think that's going to be, I'm excitedly looking forward to that, and I keep telling Laura, okay, God, I'm ready for my DNA upgrade. Anytime you want to do it, you know, here I am.
I would go for that.
Blast me. You know?
Absolutely. Hey, Richard, we're at the top of the hour. Do you want to take a short break and get some water or get something to drink or chill out a minute,
oh, sure,
or do you want to just
fine.
Go on? Okay.
Whatever you want to do, Larry.
Dorothy, you got a song you can play for a few minutes, and we'll take a break.
Sure. Anything in particular, or you want me to play
just
one?
Just pick one. Pick one. It'll be fine.
Okay, here we go.
We'll be back with Richard in a few minutes.
I enter the holy of holies. I enter through the blood.
Can you still hear me, Larry, or not?
Are we back, Dorothy?
We are back.
All right.
Go ahead, Larry.
This has really been good. Okay. Thanks, Dorothy, and thanks for the refreshment of a wonderful song there. And welcome back, Richard, to the interview. I think that
Thank you, Larry.
We have Daniel Holdings had called in. Daniel, are you there?
I'm here, guys. I'm here. Thanks so much for taking my call. You know, Richard, listening, I got about the second half hour is when I came in the discussion, and I was just bored by some of the things you were talking about just before the break, and so many things that you were addressing. I just had to call in to chip at your brain a little bit. You know, L.A. was out here a couple months ago, I should say, for a prophecy conference. And one of the things that I always appreciate.
We just got back from Pikes Peak together. We both just spoke at the Pikes Peak conference just a couple weeks ago. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things I always like about L.A. is he doesn't pull any punches. And he was quick to tell people, because, and I'm not even going to say the church that he spoke at, but they were of the pre-rapture type of mindset, and his message
right.
to them was to get in the fight, because this is a battle. This is not, gee, let's pack our bags and go, that there's a lot of stuff that's supposed to happen between now and then, and now's when you need to be in the fight. So I really appreciate, as always, his mindset. But, you know, you said something, and Larry, you picked up on it as you were talking just before the break, and that is that Christians that know the Bible, but they are not going to be ready for what's about to happen. And to me, you know, I had LA on my show, The Cutting Edge, sometime last year, I think, and you know, he said, Daniel, the thing, the only thing on the radar out there that can qualify as something that would cause, you know, a great falling away would be alien disclosure. That would be the only thing that he, and I happen to agree with him, could see on the horizon that would change the paradigm of the modern church so drastically that people would walk away in droves. And the caution that we have is that if you do not look at this issue, believer, I'm talking to the Christian, if we do not look at this issue honestly, then we're going to be blindsided by disclosure. Now, is that you guys' feeling as well? I mean, do you see this whole issue? I mean, we can get into the technology and the things, the facts or the reasons why we believe the way we believe, but do you see disclosure as being the snare for the Christian church that I'm thinking it is?
Larry, did you want to answer that, or do you want me to?
Yeah, go ahead, Richard. Go ahead. You're doing good.
Well, I think a lot of this now has become so normal to me that I wouldn't be surprised at pretty much anything that we would see in the future. Look, you know that L.A. and I work together, and his idea of the Nephilim is so that people will understand that this goes back thousands of years and it's still happening. And I truly believe that is not a crazy hypothesis. The more that we study ancient structures in Peru and look at these elongated skulls over the centuries and read ancient documents like Enoch and also Josephus, there's evidence that there has been some other entities on this planet for thousands of years, and it's come in waves, they've been wiped out. They've jumped back in and spawned again and then been wiped out again. And now here we are in the modern era with all of this UFO stuff going on all over the world, and it's all being done in a very clandestine way. Because if they were to do the same things that they did 2,000 years ago, where these creatures were born with huge heads, now today, because of all of the media we have and YouTube and the Internet and all of that, people would be going, who are these people? What are these big-headed people? Where did they come from? And then it would be obvious because, you know, it would travel fast, a message like that. So today, I think what they're doing is this abduction experience where they're smart now, and what they're trying to do is make human hybrids that look almost the same, but they really are slightly different. And at a certain point, I really think that the idea that we're not alone is going to become disclosed, and that people will embrace it as, wow, this isn't this great. And I just read recently that the Pope is preparing some sort of announcement to welcome our ET brothers. So the Vatican is deep into this. They don't want to wait for someone else to disclose. They want to be the first ones to disclose, because then it would tie it into the whole church and all of that. And this is like a church event. So to me, all of the kooky stuff you read in Revelation that makes absolutely no sense, when you look at it with these eyes, all of a sudden, oh, I could see that. Oh, this could be this. You know, and the other idea here, now that we know because of this implant thing that we had that before our very eyes disappeared and then reappeared, we know they can use technology, but they still have to yield to the Almighty. And another very confusing aspect where I think people will be tricked, a lot of what they will tell us will probably be true. And yet the overall premise of what they say will be a lie. And I think people will latch on to the truth or go, oh, yeah, well, look, where did this race of people come from? And how did these people get here? Oh, they were seated here, you know, by the ancient Sumerians. It's kind of like a Zechariah Sitchin kind of deal. And all those things will make total sense to people. It's like, well, okay, I get it. And I actually had, this is really, I mean, some Christians may be offended by this, but I have to say this. When you read the whole Genesis account, and I've talked about this with my rabbi friends as well. I said, look, what if we have the Genesis creation account, the whole Adam and Eve thing. And I said, I'm not saying that didn't happen, because I totally believe it did. But what if we know that the earth was without form and void, and it was in a mess. It had just, some kind of cataclysm had just happened to the earth. In Genesis, the earth was already pre-existing, and it was being remade. So what if other entities from some other world also seeded the earth? Then we fast forward to our time, that there could also be beings here that were from other planets that we have no idea of how they got here, and they don't fit the Genesis account. A great example of that are the Aborigines in Australia that seem to go back more than 20,000 years. How did they get here? They don't look like the rest of us. They don't seem to be a spawn of Adam and Eve. So if the ETs, when they come back and say, well, we seeded you on this planet, and they can show all these examples, some of them which may indeed have been seeded, But then there's also this new creation that happened that God was in control of that happened also. So what we have to look at is go, okay, we need to really look at this from a scientific perspective, not from an evolutionary perspective, because that doesn't work anymore, but from science mm-hmm. and from the scriptures, and really analyze this so that we're not deceived when they tell us that they made all of it, because that will be a lie. That's my own personal opinion.
What are your rabbi friends? You said you talked to your rabbi friends about what do they say about that?
They agreed with me.
You know,
in fact, there
LA,
was a long pause in our discussion. I discussed this with Rabbi Glazerson. I said, look, I'm not saying God didn't do this, because I believe he did. But what if this happened too? And he was quiet for a long time and then said, it could be. Now, neither one of us know if it's real or not. We have no way to prove it. But all what I'm trying to get people to do is expand their thinking that not everything we know now is in those ancient texts, because had God done that, it would have freaked out people in those days 3,000 years ago. They would have been so confused they couldn't have understood it. But it's just like, how would a prophet 2,500 years ago look at a red LED and describe that? What is that? How could a prophet 2,500 years ago look at a ball of plasma and describe that to us?
Mm-hmm.
How could they describe a spaceship with electricity arcing along the bottom of it, as people have described? What would he call that? Well, normally they'd say, it looked like, as they call it in the book of Ezekiel, it looked like an onyx stone, or it looked like a beryl stone. What's a beryl stone look like? Silver gray. What does a spaceship look like? Silver gray. See what I'm saying? That they
mm-hmm.
would take these examples of things that they knew what they looked like and said it were a beryl stone, as it was a ruby, as it were fire. And if you saw a plasma ball, you'd say it's fire back then, because you wouldn't
That's
know
right.
what to call it. There's no way
yeah.
to describe it, right? And I
Absolutely.
Think that in a lot of the scriptures, that's what's going on.
Well, you know, I agree with you. You know, Larry, I don't know if Richard's been, like, reading my notes from my new book, but he was talking about the Pope and stuff. It's really crazy, because all the stuff that you're talking about is actually in my new book, which I'm not done yet. But, you know, I think when it comes to the Bible, and Larry and I, we've talked about this, Larry, is that I'm convinced that we live in a supernatural world, and those things that we see in the physical realm are only a small portion of what's really going on. I think that there are layers upon layers of dimensions that we do not see, and consequently we cannot understand those things that we can't see. And you're absolutely right about the Bible. The Bible was written, everything in the Bible is true. So, audience, please don't misquote me. I'm not saying what you're not hearing. Everything in the Bible is true, and we should take it as such, but the Bible doesn't contain everything for the very reason that you just said, Richard, because not only could they not understand it, you know, 4,500 years ago, modern man couldn't understand it if everything was written. So I think God gave us as much as we needed, you know, to make it through. And
I agree.
Consequently,
I think that there would have been a falling away, because it would have seemed almost too, like, much like fantasy to people, because they didn't know about technology. And the Bible is describing technology in very ancient terms. And that gets me real excited, because I love science fiction, but this is science fact. This is like stuff that's bending physical laws. It's giving us a peek into the unknown, a glimpse into what our future is going to be like. And all of this stuff is real. It's not just make-believe, you know? So it's like, And people, there's going to be some people. I had a good friend of mine, as I was trying to explain it to him over the phone, that we pulled out an alien implant, and as soon as I said that, he just started laughing. I said, what are you laughing about? Oh, you can believe that stuff if you want to. I said, what do you mean believe it? I said, I had this thing in the lab. We put it under the FDM. We did EDX analysis. I said, this isn't a belief. This isn't a cult. I'm not formulating a religion. This is a scientific test.
Well,
and
you know,
so
tell me why you
were laughing at that.
Well, the problem is because you were challenging his paradigm, and that is the same problem, Larry, that we run into on a regular basis. When you begin to talk to people about truth and fact, and if that fact or that truth bumps up against their reality, meaning that it would change the way that they would have to look at the world, you're gonna hit resistance because it would shake them up. It would mean, Richard, that, you know, watching football on Sunday's not enough, that you would really need to know what's going on in the world, and you're challenging their paradigm, and people don't want to know that. And I think, you know, we're quickly coming into the days when they are going to be forced to accept it, but because they haven't accepted it from a biblical perspective, it's going to really mess them up. And, you know,
yeah.
I have to say,
well, I was going to say, I really like the way, Daniel, that Richard described, you know, like he was talking about a ruby and talking about the plasma and fire and using that terminology, because we don't think that way generally. Matter of fact, just before you may have heard us, Daniel, talking about, he was talking about antimatter and the new particle that they had found,
yeah,
and I brought up the fact that the super collider, you know, was being used, but you know, I got to thinking with the way Richard's describing some of these things back in the past, many, many moons ago, if I wanted to describe if I saw a super collider and the way it laid on the ground and twisted, you know, under the ground or whatever, in a circle or whatever, I would almost call it Leviathan, a super collider. How could you describe a super collider in the past, you know? And
right, or enormous wheel or something.
How could you bury something 600 feet underground? I mean, that wasn't even possible, you know, 4,000 years ago. They couldn't go but maybe 10, 15 feet with a shovel if they had one. So you're absolutely right. I mean,
well,
it's just incomprehensible to them.
Well, who was it? I think it was Daniel when he was shown some of this stuff. He got physically ill and had to rest for 3 days. Remember that?
That's right.
It was too
That's
much
exactly
for him.
Right.
You know,
go ahead, Richard. I'm sorry.
He saw all that stuff. In fact, I asked a friend the other day, I said, do you suppose that these sightings, now, here's the thing. There's good angels and bad angels. And we could juxtapose the name angel and alien in some situations, and I think we would be correct that some of them would be like what you would think of today as an alien creature, even though it's an angel, because we've got some pretty bizarre creatures that are depicted in the Book of Enoch, in the Book of Revelation.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in multiple eyes, you know, wings and arms that come out inside, and in Ezekiel chapters 10 and chapter 1, it talks about these creatures and the wheels within a wheel and all that. I think that the idea of the wheel within a wheel, the drawings, these ancient drawings we've seen are wrong. That a wheel within a wheel could mean that there's like a row of light spinning on a disc, like a UFO, and a UFO can go in any direction, just like it says in the book of Ezekiel. It doesn't have to have one perpendicular to the other wheel. I don't think the scriptures are necessarily saying that. It could be concentric circles, which is something that we see in these ships sometimes, spinning or something going on there. But I think the prophets were really laboring on even finding the words to express it on how this stuff works, but we know now that there's good angels and bad angels, and some of them are going to be here to help us, and some are going to be here to hurt us, and they both have the same kind of powers. So if we could just, if people could get used to using the word alien, that might help the secular crowd a bit more, so it doesn't wax so spiritual or sound mythical, because it's not mythical, it's real.
Well, yeah, speaking of spiritual, I don't know if both of you guys have seen it or not, that new movie Noah, boy, that brought out a lot of controversy.
I have that movie. It's I talked to a couple months ago, my friend Rabbi Glazerson was in town.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted to go down by the ocean. So I said, great, let's go down there. So I took him to Malibu. And I remember there was a Shabbat house, a Jewish place, across the street from, it's really close to Jack in the Box on Pacific Coast Highway. And so I said, let's check this out together. So we park and go in, and there's this guy that kind of looks like a rabbi running the place. Really nice character. And you know what watchers he wanted to see? I just telling him what we're doing, you know. He goes, I'd love to see the watchers on UFOs. That was the one he was most interested in. And so I gave him a copy of it. And what I'm learning is most of the rabbis in their prophetic writings that they've read, not just in the scriptures, but they have the Midrash, they have the Talmud, they've got the Kabbalah, they've got the Zohar. They have all these other Jewish mystical texts that most people don't know anything about. They talk about this, that it has to happen before the Messiah returns. So to them, the UFO phenomena is very important and not kooky and has to happen. They look forward to it as a foretaste of the return of the Messiah. And that's my Jewish friends that say that, which I thought was really fascinating. So they just totally don't think I'm crazy at all. They just think this is part of prophecy being fulfilled.
Well, you know, I appreciate, I'm sure you've heard him say this over and over again, but L.A. has a saying, you know, for those believers that are sitting back and going, well, you know, well, what are we supposed to do then? You said there's good angels, bad angels, good aliens, bad aliens, what are we supposed to do? You know, L.A. has a saying, it's rebuke first and ask questions later. Because, the good angels aren't going to be hurt by a rebuke, and you're going to be safe. So, listen, guys, I got to run to dinner, but thank you so much for taking my call, Larry. And
you can stay a little longer if you... Okay, well, enjoyed you, Daniel.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Daniel.
Okay, bye-bye.
Do we have any other callers?
I don't know, Dorothy. What?
No other callers.
Has anybody emailed any questions?
No one's asking any questions. They're just absorbing it all.
Good.
You do have to tell people that if you call in, if you have a question, put your hand up so I know, because there is one caller in the queue. There's no hand up, so I'm assuming they do not have a question.
Oh,
okay. Well, don't be afraid to ask. I'm not going to think anybody's crazy. We're way past that at this point.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you was, you know, you had talked, I can't remember who you talked to, but there was somebody that had shared with you that they felt that the hybrid or the eugenics program was done. In other words, the abductions and the hybrids that had been produced or whatever, this process had been completed. Is that what you told me? And I don't remember who said that.
That was Dr. David Jacobs.
Okay.
He's a hypnotherapist as well, but he's also super knowledgeable on this topic. He's been doing it for at least 30 years, interviewing people that have had these experiences. I've been to his house. We saw his files of his abduction, people that have been abducted. we put him in Watcher 7 and also a couple of his comments in Watchers 8, because I think he's really a lot of fun to listen to. He always has something brilliant to say. And, yes, he wrote a book called The Threat, and he believes that the hybrid program has reached its zenith and that now hybrids are being introduced back onto the Earth again. That's what he believes.
Well, I do know I used to do a little work with a Paola Harris years ago that was investigating stuff in Italy, and she did a video, a really interesting one, on a guy named Charles Hall, who
right.
was in the U.S. Air Force. Oh, do you?
Right.
I've read every one of his books. And, yeah, The Tall Whites
she
was
gave
what
me
he
her
talked
book.
About, and that
book
was
a, called, she has a book called How Does One Speak to a Ball of Light? She tends to think that the aliens are here for the good of mankind. So it's hard to convince her that there's both kinds happening.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
But she's done a lot of really good research, and she also met with Balducci, the Vatican priest that was best known for that we mentioned in Watcher 7, that believed that ETs were coming back, and he was trying to express that they're all God's creatures and all of that. So
okay.
he was very open-minded to that, and she actually interviewed Balducci. You can probably find that on YouTube if you just use those key words, and you can watch her interview that she did. But
I'm
of the mindset that there's good and bad ones up there. The reason I think that is because Christ says in Matthew 24 that at the end time that he will send his angels from the four winds, meaning from every direction, to take out, to take us out. And that's when people start disappearing. Two are working at a mill, one's taking another left. Maybe it's just as simple as these angels come and take us away. I don't know. It's like the angels or aliens or whatever. I don't know if we go up in big ships. I don't know what's going to happen. All I know is it'll be really cool, and I'm going to enjoy it.
I think we've got a caller.
Okay.
Hello?
Go ahead, Dorothy. Yeah. Hello?
Hello? Hello, this is Joy.
Yeah.
I talked to you last night. You prayed with me with Augusto.
Yeah.
And I had a UFO experience. If you would like to hear it, it sparked my interest when I heard you say that the UFOs sometimes were described as gems or burl.
I was talking to Richard. Richard talked about rubies and things. And if you want to share an experience with us, go ahead.
I went outside at 11 o'clock, and I looked up, and right hovering over the trees was a black, smooth, round stone shining, hovering with a light on it. And it looked at me, and I knew it had some intelligence, and I rebuked it in the name of Jesus Christ, and the thing started to roll away, and it rolled until it disappeared. And I just wanted to share it with you. And I had been listening to you, Larry.
We appreciate that. Interesting.
So I just wanted to let you know about that, and I'm enjoying it.
Anything you want to ask her, Richard, about that experience?
Well, sure. You said it looked like it was black. What it was oval in shape, would you say?
Like an onyx. It looked like a black, shiny, like a stone, maybe even just a smooth rock, but it was more like a jewel. And
how big was it?
I would say maybe the size of a small plane, and I wasn't afraid
at all. Okay, so maybe like 20 feet across?
Probably.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Did it have a light on it, or was it twinkling?
It
or
had
thinking?
A light, and since I've seen that, I have seen the same type of UFO on the Internet, where someone else had taken a picture of it. Uh-huh. So that kind of confirmed to me that, I wasn't just seeing things, and it was really, and I was not offended or afraid. I had heard Larry talk about an experience he had with one in his backyard when he was praying for Netanyahu, and when I started getting and delving into it further, that's when I had this experience, and then I've had another one prior that I would like to share about that star that's been up in the sky that Augusto and Larry were talking about. It's actually come at me when I was praying against it. It started moving, and then it turned into an airplane.
Really?
So, yeah. So I do believe these are intelligent entities, and they know what we're discussing or what we're listening to, and if we're the Lord's, I feel like that they probably are malevolent, and they want to try to intimidate. So they really change their goals or whatever they're trying to do when you speak the name of Jesus Christ. And if people if people could believe
I
when you tell them, they won't. Uh-huh.
I appreciate that because I think
you're
right. I think there's a lot going on, the malevolent ones, but L.A. and I have had this discussion for a couple of years, and he told me the other day, he said, I think you finally convinced me there's also good UFOs. And I said, well, I said, you can't have a war in space unless it's between two sides.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there has to be good ones up there fighting the bad ones.
I totally agree.
So at some point, you know, I would feel just fine if the good ones wanted to do something or interact with us. That would be great. But I don't want to be tricked either
by
a force that is so alien that we can't really determine whether it's good or bad right at the at the front. So that's why L.A. says rebuke first, ask questions later is probably the safest way to approach this.
Very good advice.
Well, thank you, George, for calling.
And
that was really that was good. Thank you.
Bless you.
Thanks
bye-bye.
A lot.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That was really interesting, Richard. I'll tell you what I thought of when we were talking and she was sharing about that, was talking about good or bad. I really was awestruck by the experience on one of the Watchers DVDs I watched that Gary Steadman talked about his UFO experience that probably saved his life. You remember that?
I sure do. I used that in my missing time talk that I just did at Pike Peak because there were, you know, in a Watchers, there's a lot of things that go on in the show, and so you can't just do just one story through the whole show because it would get boring. But so there's a lot of stuff that I have of Gary telling us more details that I shared with the crowd there a couple weeks ago. And we have time, I can tell you a little bit about it.
Yeah, go ahead if you would like to. Sure.
What was interesting about his experience is that he was having electrical problems with his plane, and all of a sudden this UFO appears and with an audible voice says to him, if you look to your left, you'll see a UFO. And he looks out his window, and there's this craft, very much like what's described in the book of Ezekiel, coming up alongside his plane. Them all the way to Lubbock, where his destination was. And he said he felt like this craft itself was alive. He didn't say it was just a machine. He thought it was alive. And when you read in the book of Ezekiel, it talks about the wheel, which it doesn't know how to describe a spaceship, because how would you say that? It talks about the wheels, and that in the wheels were alive, it says in so many words, in Ezekiel 10. If you read that passage, you can read that. So here we have Gary's personal experience of that, and here we have the ancient biblical text saying pretty much the same thing. So what happened was Gary was in the air for 5 hours. The plane he was flying had a 4-hour time limit before it would run out of fuel. When he landed in Lubbock, 5 hours, the entire trip took 5 hours, so he was, I don't know, 4 hours late landing in Lubbock. And he only had used a third of a tank of fuel.
Wow.
So he had physical evidence that something had happened.
Yeah, that's a clue. That's a clue.
Because it goes with my theory that he got close enough to the ship to be enveloped by its gravitational A-wave that Bob Lazar describes. And because he got close enough to that ship, he got less than 50 feet away from it. So he was enveloped by it. And so when he landed, time had sped up for him, and it was almost dark when he landed, so he was confused by that, because it shouldn't be that late in the day yet.
Yeah. Well, you know,
but
that's,
said,
you know, I had shared with you, remember, about the guy that I talked to in Mena, Arkansas, that went out and took pictures of this circular craft, saucer craft, and he said the closer he got to the craft, time began to slow down, and he got scared. And you said, well, that's exactly what would happen around one of those craft if you get in that envelope,
right,
as you call it.
That's right. The way Lazar describes it, it puts out a heart-shaped, donut, toroidal kind of shaped field. And I mean, it's like, okay, this is very scientific. I mean, we understand about flux density and magnets and electromagnetic lines of force. I mean, that's how motors work. I mean, this is ancient technology to us. I mean, we've been familiar with this stuff for 150 years. Well, the ship just puts out a gravitational field like that. Okay. Next. All right, I get it. That's
there you
what
go.
It does. You know?
Uh-huh.
So it's like, okay, if it does that, then we could postulate that if you get too close to that, you're going to have a time shift thing happen. Because you're too close to this other ship. But what Gary said, which I think he did have a positive experience and not a negative one, was that he said
right.
after he had that experience that the scriptures opened up to him. He was able to understand stuff that he was reading from the Bible that never made sense to him before. For him, he had a spiritual experience involved. So I thought that was really interesting.
Well, one of the things that, you know, we always think that, or we want to think that all angels look like men or women, but they don't. I mean, you know, look at the experience with Moses and the burning bush. That burning bush wasn't a man or a woman on a visit. You know, angels, I suppose, and from what I understand, can take on shapes or present themselves as whatever they need to for the purpose they're there for.
Right. I think that's exactly right. In fact, you remember Howard Storm, who I've talked about before, that had the after-death experience,
uh-huh.
says that once we're in the heavenly and our bodies are upgraded, that we have that ability too. Like, say we know a loved one, it's just to them as they best remember us in whatever year that they knew us. And then we can bring them into heaven without them feeling that they're alone or not recognizing you because you're of a different time, you know, when you never knew them. Like say you didn't know your grandmother when she was a young woman because that would have been impossible. So she appears like she did when you were a child, and you remember what she looked like. But have you seen that film that just came out, Heaven is for Real?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've read both books about it, and I've seen the film. And you remember in Heaven is for Real, at the beginning, there's this little girl that's drawing the picture of Christ or drawing Jesus.
Right.
I've researched her on the internet and found her website, and she has drawn some incredible stuff. Matter of fact, she was about 4 years old and had her experience. And do you know, I found I got one of her books of her art, and it shows Tower of Babel, and she says that was known as the Tower of Spheres. And it's not just brick. There were spheres on that tower. In other words, she said ancient technology. It goes well beyond just a brick and mortar, you know?
I believe that. It could very well have been a launching pad for space vehicles and all of that, because the scriptures talk about the Tower of Babel of reaching up into the heavens. Remember that?
Uh-huh.
And God didn't want these beings to control the earth again after it just destroyed the earth because of them. So
all of this is kind of interesting because when you talk about Nimrod, you know, in there it talks about how Nimrod, I think it's in Gilgamesh or somewhere, it talks about there's a change, like a DNA change, and they change into something else, you know.
Well,
and
Roger and L.A. and I used to talk about that all the time. Roger thought that possibly humanity might have been telepathic before. Think about that.
Would not be surprised. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I do know that Stan Deo told me he's got a stele, as he calls it. You've probably seen it because you've been to his house, but he has a stele of the ancient Tower of Babel, and it appears to him that there was possibly a portal, a technological portal on the top of that tower that could extend into
could
other dimensions.
Been.
And I say that
I think it could have been.
He was talking about he believed it was a technological portal, you know, like Stargate, something like that was at the top of that Tower of Babel.
There's times when I wonder if all the movies that are out that have all of these concepts that you're saying in them are there to just make us realize that this stuff, even though it's fictional in the films, it's not really all that impossible. Have you ever watched any of the Iron Man movies, Larry?
Yeah, I saw one. I haven't kept up with all of them, but I did see one. Uh-huh.
Well, what's interesting is, remember when I was talking a few minutes ago about element 115 and using a particle accelerator to make a new element? That is the crux of what happens in the second Iron Man movie.
Oh, okay.
Just really interesting. You know, he had, in Iron Man, he has this, it's like a little reactor that's in his chest, okay, that keeps his heart going and pulls metal pieces out of his heart. It powers his electromagnet, okay? So the metals that he was using to make that thing, it's a little miniature arc reactor, they call it in the film, okay?
Uh-huh.
But that was poisoning his bloodstream in the second Iron Man movie. So what he has to do, he has to come up with a new element. So he goes into his lab and he puts basically a atom smasher together, a particle accelerator, and he makes a new element. And that's one of the biggest things in the whole film. He has this big laser kind of thing, and he moves it over and shoots another piece of metal with it and creates a new element, puts that in his chest, and that's what powers his heart. So
that's incredible.
We're seeing that happen, and now we know that's what they just did in Russia to make element 115.
Exactly.
And you go, wow, life.
Wow, I tell you what, it's just amazing what's out there, and a lot of it, people don't really, you know, I like to read, I read a lot of books, actually, and of course I watch movies too, but you can glean a lot of information that's real. You know, there's a lot of times, and Daniel Holdings would laugh at me for saying this, but there's sometimes these fiction novels are not all just fiction.
No, I don't think so. I think this is why, Larry, that when you read ancient texts, they say, you know, there's words that cannot be uttered, or there's stuff that we, that the heart of man cannot conceive of. And I think it's because the veil is slightly being peeled away, and we're starting to really get it. And if we're bold enough to take that veil and heal it as much as we can and ask for God's help. Show us the truth, God. We're ready. We're ready now. We got to see what's really going on behind the curtain. And I think there's amazing stuff that we have no idea how cool it's going to be until, you know, we're changed and we become like
you're right. I think you're right. Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
It's exciting to me.
Listen, we've only got just a few minutes left. What have you got up your sleeve as far as, you know, don't give away any secrets, but, and for those that haven't watched Watchers 8 yet, I encourage them to watch it. It says Watchers 8, The Cloak of Secrecy. What are you guys working on Watchers 9? I know you're already looking that way, but and don't give any secrets away, but can you give us a clue?
I think we're going to do a segment on Myth and Watchers 9. I think we will. We're also going to do we've got people who are willing to we've got people who want to send us metal samples of various alien things that we want to examine. We have Dr. Brooks Agnew, who has agreed to go into the lab with us to help evaluate some of these things, and Brooks is a really great guy. Really super smart scientist. And so I think we're going to do that. And then there's probably some stuff that I'll learn in Israel in a couple weeks when I'm actually there that will also be in Watchers 9 that I won't be able to tell you about it now because I don't know myself yet what it's going to be. But
that's fair.
But I think that, you know, what I think is going to happen and what usually happens is that we shoot it as it happens. That's all I can say. There is no script until later. I never have a script when I shoot a Watchers. Ellie and I will have an idea. We need to go see Jaime Massaw, or we need to go back to Peru, or we need to go visit so-and-so. And we do that. I never know what's going to happen, Larry. I haven't the slightest clue. I have an idea what I think is going to happen, but what actually happens and what we think is going to happen are often two separate things. So
the film
gets done once I have all the pieces to it, and then I can take it into editing and go, well, this is interesting. That was really cool. This fits with that, and it's like a big, enormous jigsaw puzzle. By the time I put it all together, it starts to make some sense. That's how Watchers are put together. We're not making it up. We're just reporting on what we saw.
Wow, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, I tell you, do we have any last questions, Dorothy, at all, or Carl?
Yes, we have a question from the chat room from Darnett. I don't know if you know her or not.
Well, I think I've heard that name. Go ahead.
She wants to know if you think there is a connection to the Watchers and possibly a connection to ancient Egypt. And she has seen a ship like the one Richard showed you on the video that he sent you. She has seen one like that.
Oh, it's kind of a boomerang-shaped craft? Oh, I wish she would call in. I'd like to ask her about it. Well,
you could call in
if
she
Egypt,
has the time. Yeah.
Sure.
We can still continue if she calls in before the before 3 minutes round.
Yeah,
Darnett,
tell Darnett to call in if she's got a second, and she can talk to him herself. Go ahead, Richard, about Egypt while we're waiting.
Well, we know that there were elongated head people in Egypt, just like there were in Peru. And that seems to be evidence of another strain of Nephilim. And there was also, in Exodus, all sorts of, I guess what you'd call magic going on in Egypt. I mean, remember when Moses threw his staff down and became a snake, and so the priests there, they threw their staff down. I mean, it was all like, that was like just another day in the temple in Egypt in those days. I mean, that's just amazing when you think about it. We read this stuff and we don't absorb really what's going on. Moses' staff was more powerful. So there could have been an alien thing going on in Egypt. It wouldn't surprise me at all that there might have been. And I think a lot of these enormous structures were all a result of the Nephilim in Egypt and in Peru and Stonehenge and the whole deal. I think they're all this race of giants pre-flood building all of this stuff on the Earth's magnetic ley lines.
That was interesting, you know, in recent, I guess, where Peru and Chile and, you know, where you guys were, a lot of that stuff, you couldn't build it today.
No. No, there's no construction damage. There's no rubbing marks on anything. Nothing was dragged on the ground by ropes. It's a ridiculous notion. These things were precisely and intricately formed and had a purpose. And we don't, you know, we don't have that technology today. We can't fathom what they were doing with it. But we do know that the stones were mostly piezoelectric, which means that they, if you squeeze them, they produce electricity. And if you hit them with electricity, they move. So it's like how they were using that technology, I don't know. Maybe to communicate with each other.
Wow. Hello?
Darnette, ask
yes.
Richard what you wanted to share with him.
I wanted to share with him, I saw one of those round things, the windows of it moving down along the highway, you know, one night. You were in your office, and I was looking out the windows at the back of the house, and I saw it moving, and at first I thought it was car lights, and then it came within view. It was like a big house. Only thing, it was round, and it had windows all the way around it. And I couldn't see anything.
Was it round? Was it spherical, or was it shaped?
Well, the side I saw, it was at that. The side I saw was sort of like it was curved. So I would say, you know, from my viewpoint, it looked round.
Like a ball?
But I couldn't say. Well, no, I'm saying like a long, looks like an oval, kind of like your boomerang on one side, but with lights all the way around that side. And it moved above the treetops and then moved along kind of like the highway and above that area. And it was very bright. I could actually see windows. You know, it was that bright.
Did you see, when you say bright, were the lights moving on its surface, or did they stay in one place?
No.
What color was
it? Well, they moved at first. It was like, you know how yellow house lights, and then they got bright and brighter and brighter, and then as it got closer to me, first I saw the lights first. I thought it was car lights because there is a highway there. But this was so gigantic, it was like a moving house. You know what I'm saying? Only thing I saw was just windows. And it floated above the treetops along that highway, and then all of a sudden it just disappeared. It's like it cloaked.
Interesting.
It was really interesting.
Well,
yeah.
In Bob Lazar's instructional piece that I've been telling you guys about, he mentions that when they would turn the power of their gravitational system up to a certain point, the ship would become invisible.
Wow.
And
that's cool.
So essentially, you can't look through that level of time anymore. It's gone past what we can see, where they're actually warping the fabric of space. So maybe that's what's going on when these ships disappear. It's actually, they just turn up the gravity generators in them until they're completely surrounded by this field, and then the ship, for all intents and purposes, becomes invisible.
Maybe when people think they actually, I've heard a lot of people refer to something like they blink out. Maybe that's what people are seeing. They just become invisible.
Now, I don't know if that's what happened to our implant. The implant seemed to be cloaking itself, so we couldn't see it. I don't think there was any time displacement going on there. There was something else, some other kind of technology was preventing our equipment from measuring it anymore. It was very interesting, though. I found that very interesting because none of the little boxes we brought, like the Gauss meter and the stud finder, none of them worked either. So it wasn't just the big, expensive ultrasound machine. Nothing worked.
Wow.
Very, very, very interesting to experience that. I felt really privileged to be there and see it, you know, trying to trick us like that.
Well, Richard, we're totally out of time. Matter of fact, we ran over, but I appreciate so much you coming on and sharing with us. And this has been incredible. I mean, this has been a good show, and I do very much appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Larry. I just wanted to direct everybody to watcherstv.com because we're starting to make that happen now, too.
Oh, I was going to bring that up. I forgot. I'm going to post that
That's
on my
okay.
group stuff. Hey, listen, God bless you, Richard, and I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thank you, Larry, so much. Have a great
Thanks
evening.
Thanks so much. It's been
Thank
wonderful.
Y'all.
And thank you, Dorothy. Thanks, Darnette. Thank you, Dorothy.
You're welcome. I did post that link in the chat room to watch his TV.
Oh, good deal. Thanks a lot. And have you a good trip, too. I know you're going to take a trip to Augusto's. I think you are, anyway.
Yes, I am. It's a whole big hour away.
Wow, praise the Lord. Well, listen, I'll be praying for you. So God bless, and thanks for helping us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.